This is the fourth session of Making Peace. It is August 13th, Friday, and our subtopic is Maintaining Solidarity. Since none of you have been here before, if you'd like, I'll sort of review what we have done this week and what then get to what maintaining solidarity means. And obviously, you're not coming just because that's the only topic that was of interest to you in this subtopic, but because this is the day you could come. The first one was called Defining and Directing, and we discussed what a definition of peace would be and what components would go into it. And among the things that we said was that peacemaking is a very active thing. Just the verb making, peacemaking, emphasizes the action that's needed, because very often when people hear peace, they think absolutely quiet, still, no movement, no controversy, everything harmonious and serene. And peace is not necessarily serenity in that sense. We talked about a lot of those definitions, and some of the things that people brought out as far as what was required for peacemakers: listening, articulating, advocating, questioning, forgiving, appreciating, nurturing, and cooperating. And so we were emphasizing those things, talking about what it meant to be a peacemaker. I quoted from Cicela Bock's book, The Strategy of Peacemaking, in which she states the four principles required for peace that Immanuel Kant gives. One of them was renunciation of violence, or absence of violence, if you're going to have peace. An insistence, which doesn't mean an absence of all conflict or of all differences in the sense of conflict. An insistence on truth and accuracy. Fidelity to commitment, dependability in a sense, and a strict limitation on secrecy. And we talked about how the truth, which the limitation on truth would be all of the truth, and when we in court we say, I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So in a sense, that's what's involved. And she says these are necessary for any relationships, whether they're interpersonal, although sometimes in our personal relationships we permit more privacy, and in the relationships in community we permit more privacy on certain things than we would in, say, international relations. So these four principles were the things that we then talked a little bit about as to how that would work out in our ordinary peacemaking things.
You see why they're having such difficulty in bonding. The connectors are made only to be broken.
And one thinks of our own foreign policy.
Oh yeah.
And what it means to be an American and to deal with our government. So those were the things that we kept in mind. A wonderful thing, metaphor that she used was the metaphor of climate. She said, "Now these are ideals, and we might say they can never be achieved 100%, and therefore, you know, why bother?" But she emphasizes that climate is a mixture of things, and within climate, we don't always have optimum conditions, and so a healthy condition in which these things can be, an optimum climate in which life can survive. None of us breathe pure oxygen. We have a mixture of things that give us an atmosphere that is. This one's maybe better than the other one. So she mentions climate, and I think that was a very important thing for me, because when you realize that the ideal is so hard to achieve, then if you can say, I can deal with a certain amount of lack of perfection. And we talked a bit, we coined a new word. We talked about survival, surviving, and thriving. And if the climate is adequate for surviving, the minimum requirements almost, we have survival. If it's a really good mixture so that you can thrive, we don't have a word for that, so we coined thrival. So we'd like a climate that in which there of thrival for peace. But survival in many parts of the world is right now also an optimistic sort of thing and a great hope. So then the second session which was on nurturing the center, was a matter of talking about how it is possible to continue to be an active peacemaker, what kinds of things are needed for regaining the resources that we need to have in order to participate in some of these very challenging tasks. And one of the things that had come up in the first session was that sometimes people who are working for peace are not peaceful people. They don't have within them a center of peace. They have a cause, but they don't have a center of peace. And so that was really the focus for that next session. And from that we said, we are all called. Everyone is called to be a peacemaker. It's not an option. It is a requirement of our faith. Hi, welcome.
Oh,
we're just kind of reviewing what happened the last couple times. Were you here?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I
got a
shift.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Missed them all for the same reason.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, so we're already on session two, I guess, and we need to move ahead so we get to session four, I suppose. In session two, we emphasize that everyone is called. It is not an option. And that to be, it's from the Vatican Council statement on peace, peacemaking is not an optional commitment. It is a requirement of our faith. We are called to be peacemakers, not by some movement of the moment, but by Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And secondly, and very important, we all have a next step. So that no matter where you are, no matter in your commitment, in your interest, in whatever, we all have a next step. And sometimes it's hard to hear that. You want to say, okay, I'm done. I'm going to go this far, I'm done. But there is always a next step, and that might be obvious, and it might be a mystery. It might be something you are waiting to do, and it might be something you're really holding back from. All violence is interrelated, is the third point, and therefore all peacemaking is interrelated. So if you say, what I'm doing is not very important, it's not out there on the front lines, doesn't make the headlines, that's not the issue, because all peacemaking is also interrelated. And peacemaking is a religious vocation and a spiritual task. If we think of that aspect of it, it will help us as we go along. And we use community to do much of our peacemaking and to create the changes. The changes have to happen in the community and through the community. And we also talked about all the various communities we belong to, whether it is our small families or small friendship circles or larger work circles, or we can have many, many communities that we live in. If you live in a very small town, sometimes all of those circles are right on top of each other, and sometimes some people love that, and some people don't like that, and some people have many, many circles going up. And any renewal and reforming begins with small groups of people, so that we don't need to worry about whether or not we have hosts of people working with us. Indeed, anything that begins usually begins in small groups, so that the challenge to begin is not a challenge that should be stopped because there are only a few people. Many fantastic things have happened with one person talking to another. The two Nobel Peace Prize winners from Ireland, the two women, a Roman Catholic and a Protestant woman, just met and said that something needs to be done, and they started a very important movement that way. And it isn't easy. It's the last one. It often isn't easy, and therefore it is good to come together and to be in touch simply sometimes to talk about our work, whether it is the actual task itself or to talk about the task. And the exhibit that is on the board is the beginning of a long-term, never-ending, perhaps, oral history project of peacemakers. Five of those peacemakers were the leaders of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, the directors at one time or another. And the other five are I think, all of them in the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, but have had a different task, and I chose them. I have interviews with about 25 people already, so these I chose partly because of the variety of the tasks that they were doing to show some of the many ways you can be a peacemaker. And I've been asking for comments. I haven't been getting a lot of them, so give me your comments. But one of them said, I just didn't know there were this many Lutherans doing this many different things. And so it is a matter of saying, yes, there are, and to be able to connect with them and to be encouraged.
The answer should be get them all to subscribe to Lutheran Peace Fellowship.
Yes, and I didn't come, as I said to one person, I didn't come with all that material to do that, but someone said you should have. And I have a blank here, if anyone, yeah. They have marvelous material.
A lot of material.
And very good. Very good material.
Yeah, I think anything that can be done to bring that to the attention of mainstream Lutherans.
Yeah, and we're not a traditional peace church, although one would say every Christian church is ought to be a peace church. And peacemakers, except unless you were in one of the mainline peace churches, the peace group is usually is a smaller group and on the edge.
Well, there are no mainline peace churches, are there?
Well, it depends on what you're going to call mainline, I guess. But I mean the Society of Friends is,
sure.
And the Mennonites are, and
right.
Let's see.
But those are relatively small. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. They're not the largest groups. So then, the third session, we talked about reducing violence, and we had a very interesting discussion of the ways and of the kinds of violence that people felt was most prevalent in their lives, and ways in which to reduce them, and there are people out there, I think. I don't know, maybe they're just looking for them. So we talked about alternatives to violence, and we focused really on some more practical things about, we say you can do it nonviolently or violently, and it seems like those are the two options, but there is this continuum that goes through, and that somewhere on that continuum there's another way, and to continue to look for that other way. We've been emphasizing certain words over and over again. One of them has been continuum, which means you can come on to something, whether it is a part of the problem or a part of the solution, at any point, and wherever you come, there is a next step. So you can work on that, and also to see that things are not always just rigidly one way or the other, that to look for these different choices and to look for ways of bringing things together. So let's get on to part four, which is maintaining solidarity. What I had in mind from that is I sort of had to plan four sessions and to present some variety was to say, making peace, we've talked about certainly in the third session when we're talking about violence, we live in such a violent society that to be a peacemaker is to go out there and just do anything to put down, to decrease the violence, whether that means wherever you are, when you hear and see or understand something is going to happen, if you just simply maintain a presence that says, when I hear people condemn other people, when I hear people make gratuitous remarks about another group of people, I get upset, or I'm unhappy. Even if you just maintain a flag of tolerance, sometimes it's a help for reducing violence. I think I work in an academic community. We know how to use words very well. We know how to use words so well that you can hardly tell. It's hard to challenge when somebody is putting someone else down or putting another idea or a group of people down. It's done so carefully that you know that nobody can call you on it. But there is a way in which you can say, I'm hearing anger, I'm hearing hatred, I'm hearing something, which doesn't, again, and it's a very difficult thing to do because you can contribute to an even more violent and more confrontational situation. So we're all out there, on the front lines, in a sense, one way or another, at all times. We all have opportunities. But I thought that perhaps people might like to speak about, in maintaining solidarity, speak about their relationship to, or their understanding of, or their continuing concern and ways of dealing with those parts of the world where violence is extreme and the situations are more extreme than they are here. We talk about areas and groups within the United States as well. I was thinking in terms also of groups within the United States with all of the refugees that come one way or another, of areas like El Salvador, Guatemala, South Africa, the Mideast, wherever people had experience or interest. However, this is really your time as well, and I'd like to get response from that. What would you, and we don't have to follow maintaining solidarity, but we can if you would like. Or we can say, since basically the people, all of you here, except for Mark, are here for the first time, we can talk about anything you want to talk about in making peace.
Because it doesn't matter if there's two different levels there. As soon as you take it beyond the personal level and go into international conflicts or ethnic conflicts, it suddenly becomes a political thing. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different issue in some ways.
Right, although here's a little bit more about what I meant. I have been very interested in the problems in El Salvador for a long time, since about 1982. I've been to El Salvador in 1988 and again last year in 1992. I'm really removed from El Salvador, however, and I'm limited in how much I can give in financial aid. But I'm really brought into the problems and the issues of those people for a number of reasons. So then what, and when I was there, and I met many people, and they told me their stories, and it's a fantastic thing for somebody. In 1988, when I was there, and people told me their stories, that was a dangerous thing for them to do, mm-hmm. to even mention it. The fact that they would tell me these stories indicated a great deal of trust and respect. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what could one do to help? And they said, remember us. You are in solidarity with us if you remember us. So, how you remember people in prayer.
Sure.
You remember them by writing to your congressman and saying, stop funding that war in El Salvador, because the misery of those people is caused by my tax money,
mm-hmm. right.
my guns. I saw those helicopters. They flew over me when they were scanning the barrios. Mm-hmm. I saw the guns, and it was not during a conflicted time. So I mean, my representative knows when he sees me. I think it's from El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And if I say about anything about any other place, he's a little surprised.
I think the example of maintaining solidarity is really important. I think I was hearing there was a from the situation in Sarajevo. There's mm-hmm. a little girl, Mia. What, I don't know her name. Maybe she was flown to London for surgery. Did you hear? She has there was a whole lot of commentary around the fact that all of a sudden, for a whole bunch of people, you know, this thing that's happening in the other end of Europe became very real because they were dealing with, you know,
one human being,
and somehow that seems to me to be an example of solidarity that breaks through. I mean, we get anesthetized or numbed because there's so much of it, and we also feel guilty because, just as you're saying, like in Somalia, for example, we arm them and then they use our stuff and then we have to go over and try to straighten their stuff.
They say, we've got some more, we'll bomb you with the rest. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
But I guess the example of solidarity that, you know, in ordinary congregations where you get people to support children mm-hmm. through the various organizations in third world countries and so on. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
I think you're right. Solidarity means many things, and again, it's not one, and it's not in one place.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is an important kind of solidarity,
yeah.
an important.
I mean, I guess I'm just speaking out of experience as a pastor, who, I mean, I know how easily, even in myself as well as in members of the congregation, you start talking about these situations, and you immediately trigger all kinds of guilt, and then they don't want to deal with it. You know, they don't want to hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's brings up something that I think is really important in peacemaking, and that is you've got to feel responsible. We've been defining terms really a lot. You've got to feel responsible, but you don't have to, and that responsibility might have some guilt in it. But guilt can close you up, and responsibility should open you. So we are responsible, and therefore we should do something. Oscar Romero said, all of us can do something. I used to say, well, as you can tell, I changed words around. I used to say, each of us can do something. And I realized, and this is a cultural difference between Latin America and U.S. In the U.S., we're individuals. And I can do it, and you must do it, and we're individuals, and we may come together in community. So one and one and one, and you know, each one of you can do something. And he said all of us can do something. And when I realized that when he said that, the Salvadorans hearing it said all of us, and that meant each one of us, but each one of us connected. Mm-hmm. And so
so
all of us is what should be said.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean, since it's all of us, no one will notice if I don't do something.
Yeah.
In community, you do notice if someone isn't doing something. I mean,
yeah.
Dishwashing team, for example, you're at Holden.
I guess the complication I worry about, and then I mean, I had some experiences too. I was in South Africa, and during the elections of '86, I was in Dublin, Ireland, when Bobby Sands died in 1980 during the hunger strike. I was in Israel during the Intifada. I mean, so I've seen some of this, and the whole issue is in terms of solidarity. Solidarity is a complication of. Solidarity in terms of getting peace can often be interpreted as choosing sides and escalating the conflict. And, you know, I don't know, for me, peacemaking becomes a complicated issue then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think one of the big difficulties we have here in the United States is exactly as Steve said, that there is a tendency to choose sides, mainly because our government has already chosen those sides. As you pointed out, El Salvador, Nicaragua, we were bombarded with propaganda ever since 1980, which was out and out lies about what was going on down there. And most of the people in the public, that's all they heard. But those of us who got the information from Quest for Peace, Witness for Peace, and Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and all of that information, knew better. We had solidarity with those people, but it was very difficult to make inroads into the general American public. Same thing with Israel. Very, very difficult because we're sending them $3 billion a year to murder Arabs. And Panama, and of course the propaganda machine got better and better and better. And I have maintained that the best propaganda machine in the history of the world was the Persian Gulf War. We were forced by the media to choose sides. I mean, the American public fell right into it because of a lack of information.
Mm. Did you think we were given a choice?
No.
Okay.
No, we weren't. We sitting here in this room had a choice, and it was a very difficult choice to make. Mm-hmm. The minute that first bomb fell, we became a small minority. Mm-hmm. And I cried.
Yeah.
We were in a demonstration in Missoula, Montana on the 14th of January. In 1991, thousands of 5,000 people out there down marching from the University of Montana to downtown, and it was wonderful. Everybody was, you know, solidarity. And then the bombs fell on the 16th. My 58th birthday was the most horrible birthday I ever had. And we suddenly became a very tiny group.
And could no longer.
We were screaming out, and we're not heard because of Bush's propaganda machine. So the solidarity in that respect is very difficult to achieve. And it's up to us who know better to just stand firm. This is, you know, this is one of the reasons I come to Holden. The strength to go out and
so you were doing session two here at Holden. Finding, renewing yourself.
It seems in that case that we do have a more direct, you know, I mean, again, back to the thing of choosing sides, because there, when the U.S. is involved, I mean, we know when our country is involved, we have a very direct responsibility, I think, there, I mean, in terms of stopping war, stopping arms shipments around the world, and so forth.
Do any of you know Cicela Bach's book, A Strategy for Peace? In that book, she begins her book with describing a statue in the Boston Common called Partisans. This is interrupting and probably throwing us away from a direction you want to go. So I was in Boston this year, and I took pictures of this, and she discusses this whole concept of partisan and commitment in this sort of sense. Would you like to hear what she says about it? And would you like to see the pictures?
Yes.
Good. Now, you could for me, to look at a picture of a statue is a really hard thing. And it was very interesting. A storm link, you know, a storm fence has gone up all the way around the trees that are, if the statue's here and there are trees that go the length of the common this way. And they've got this fence around so that no one will disturb these trees so the trees can grow. And in the middle of it is a statue. So it's really hard to get a good picture of it or to see it. And so I thought, well, maybe it's appropriate somehow that it is this way. But it looks a little bit funny. But let me just read you what she says about it. It's by a Polish sculptor, Andrzej Pijinski, who's been in the United States since 1974. And it's called Partisans. And it portrays five men on horseback carrying guns and long spears. The men of varying ages are exhausted. Though they sit straight up in their saddles, their heads are bent. Their emaciated horses have gaunt legs and narrow, elongated heads, stretching forward almost impossibly beyond their bodies. A plaque explains that the sculpture represents the universal struggle for human rights and calls the men desperados, wandering without a chance of victory, continually fighting and full of inner spirit. It quotes the artist as saying that his sculpture is a tribute to people everywhere who are willing to fight for freedom. And then she goes on to examine the tension regarding the use of the word partisan. A tension that is reflected in the two meanings that term carries. On the one hand, partisan has the morally neutral term of meaning volunteer combatant, someone who has chosen sides and takes an active part in resisting. And on the other hand, it has a negative meaning of a partial, unreasoning, and at times even fanatical adherent to a cause. For Bach, the tensions evoked by the statue Partisans and by the double meaning of the word partisan raise, and I quote her here, a question at the root of oral moral response. How can it be that people whose lives we see as precious and worthy of the fullest respect should be so vulnerable to suffering and injustice? End of her quote. The sense of and concern for human dignity and worth underlies the most elemental impulses of self-preservation, kinship, and group loyalty. The source is well of the insistence on universal human rights in many traditions, and it's the basis for our sense of justice, this sense of and concern for human dignity and worth. So that plays off against all of the sense that we said of this real commitment to, you know, fanatical adherence to a cause, or a volunteer combatant choosing sides. And there's a way in which we can't avoid choosing sides. And if you don't choose one side, if you don't choose, that's a choice. I tell our kids, you don't choose, you've made a choice, because there are consequences either way. So, So, how does that fit into what we were discussing about your... about where things are, or about...
One of the things I find interesting is the in contrast to the men, mm-hmm. or at least I looked at it first, is the horses. I mean, the sort of anguish that, I'm not sure.
I didn't even bring all the pictures I took of the horses, of their faces and their expressions. And in some sense, they were, since the men are so erect and so dejected almost, the most movement, the most energy came from the anguish in those animals.
Stretching.
Exhausted and turned up. Yeah.
I can't reach you, too.
Yeah. Straining.
My hand is like, it was like the I think the city's straight in the saddle still, you know, it's like a contradiction there, because, you know,
the weariness.
The moral strength of sitting straight, but then still their heads are.
And you get, you know, it says, representing universal struggle for human rights, desperados wandering without a chance of victory.
Well, that made me think of.
Continually fighting the full of interest.
I know, it made me think of Don Quixote. I mean, at a different level.
Yeah, indeed.
And also of Guernica, the horses, you know, that famous painting which the. But go ahead, you will.
Almost as though we can see it better or stronger in the face of an animal than in the human face. When we see a human face contorted in that way or stretched, I don't know. Do you think?
I don't know, except that the. That the animal is just felt freer to let it be known that they were really. But she is presenting partisans as a positive role there. Is that, or not she, I'm sorry. She's
well, the sculptor is a male,
yeah.
Andrei Pachinsky. And what she is saying is partisans has these two, there's a tension between the two. Between somebody who has a deep commitment that is fierce and inner and good, and who's chosen a side, and of course then I suppose the value comes as to which side you've chosen, and somebody who's just a fanatic.
Okay.
And will not see any reason. So one could say, in a sense, those are polar positions. Maybe, you know, I'm forever talking about our continuum, and that those are polar positions.
I'm sure there are lots of responses. One is that somehow, I've always thought that being partisan was somehow morally superior to indifference, which is, I think, sort of a my generation male strategy, you know, thing you just sort of be cool and stay away and be distant. And if I don't notice it, it isn't real. And so somehow the partisan.
Not only males do it, I can assure you, but.
So somehow, certainly it's powerful and moving.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, like the point you raised about being called, we're not just said, well, it would be nice if you were peacemakers, as Christians are called to be peacemakers.
I keep thinking, when you're choosing sides, you're choosing based upon what you know. And I can't remember who it was you quoted in the first session that you repeated, the four points that were
made. That was Kant.
Okay, Kant's truth. Mm-hmm. You need to know truth. Mm-hmm. And I think this was one of the most frustrating things about the Reagan and Bush administrations in Central America, is they manipulated the truth, so the truth wasn't known to too many people. And how do you become, you know, if you're a partisan and you really feel what you're told, you're not dealing with truth. Mm-hmm. And that is so difficult.
Well, to be a partisan for truth, and it really
partisan for truth
means that it means that we might be enemies in some sense.
Yeah.
It's some point along the way, but ultimately the basis for reconciliation.
I was thinking about the partisans, the average American citizen who knew only what he was told by the press was
We also knew that we drove our cars because of the oil. I mean, that was the other the subtext there.
Right. Nobody's hands are clean. Cicero Bock also. That's a very interesting book, and I have it here at Holden, but I didn't bring it today.
Did she write that book after Lying or before?
After.
After Lying. Yeah.
She wrote this book. Cicero Bock is the daughter of Alva Myrdal, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. She and her husband had won the Nobel Prize for social. For their work on American sociology, which came out, they did that in the 1950s, and I think it must have gotten the prize in the 60s, which really brought to the attention of the world and to the United States the race problem in the United States. And then she worked with the UN, Alva Myrdal did, and won the Peace Prize for her work with UNICEF and her strategies there. Cicero Bock is her daughter, and as her mother was growing older in the later years of her life, wanted to write a biography of her. And so she did the work on that biography. And that book actually was published, I think, maybe in Sweden at about the same time as A Strategy for Peace was published, but then it was translated and published later here. But her mother was adamant that the peacemaking should get, you know, we should talk about it outside of all this idealism, and it should, we should get at some of the really root causes and speak pretty directly about it. And so Cicely Bock's work has been done focused towards that. And what she does in this book is she takes Kant's requirements from his essay Perfect Peace, and which he says is unattainable, and then the work of Karl Clausewitz, who sort of wrote the manual of war making that has and militarism that has been the Bible for the military of all Western Europe and the U.S. included. And he wrote this in the early 1800s, maybe he wrote it in about 1820s. And so, and she takes the principles that he says are necessary for, and why militarism is necessary, why armies are necessary, and how they should operate, and so forth. And so instead of discounting them, she says, okay, let's accept that. Let's take his strategies and look at them, and finds that in today's world, because of increased nationalism, because of nuclear weapons, his conditions aren't fulfilled, and therefore the reasons for having an army and for having military solutions are gone. And she puts those two together in a very interesting way, in a very accessible way. I could understand this. And then she goes on to discuss then what a strategy for peace would be. And so I really recommend that book. And I this, although it doesn't fit in necessarily the best right now, she does say nobody's hands are clean. Everybody is involved in some way or another. We are U.S. citizens, and therefore we're really involved. And
what other people perceive us as involved. You know, like a lot of people have traveled, and other people perceive every American as involved in what America is doing.
They're wrong.
Yeah, because you're always justifying. I mean, I always find myself justifying. And it's pleasant to go to some place like Costa Rica, for example, where the people there love Americans. America's done a lot of good things, building houses, as opposed to going other countries where you really get the cold shoulder.
Right. But what's amazing to me is to go to a place like El Salvador, to go to Mexico, to go to Guatemala, and people say, we hate your country's policies,
yes,
but we don't hate you. Yeah. And I think, wow, if we could learn to do that in the United States, do not hate the people, but to hate the policy.
The system.
That would be good.
And when you mentioned that type of thing, I was reminded of Joe Bart's book, Dismantling Racism, mm-hmm. which is one of the greatest books I've read recently.
Mm-hmm.
And it really pins down everybody in this country. From mm-hmm. the corporate structure of the individual, we are all racists, and he explained all of it. Wonderful book.
Ways in which we would not otherwise.
We would never. They're so subtle, mm-hmm. but he develops it in such a great way. He's been here on the teaching staff. Dismantling Racism by Joe Bart.
And that's also a very readable,
yes.
accessible book.
Well, that's the way Joe is. I've mm-hmm. attended his sessions while he's mm-hmm. been here, and his wife Susan Kirkloff.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very involved and easy to talk with. A mm-hmm. good dialogue, and it is a very readable book.
Yeah, an important book.
Very important.
Solid.
I had the book for over a year mm-hmm. before I do that at Holden. I buy a dozen books and bring them home, and sometimes I don't get to them. And you're always asking me, which books have I read lately? And this one's still on the shelf.
Yeah.
And I'm writing it down.
Right. Well, but we that, have to begin somewhere.
Well, I read it
first.
I read it last spring.
The reading.
And finally, I got to it last spring. And putting it together with what I heard from Joe during. Oh, he was one of the most instrumental people in getting our Rainbow and Mountaintop experience going here
mm-hmm.
At Holden.
Yeah.
So.
So what Cicely Bock says, we're all guilty. But we can all of us can do something. And this is the way she says it. There's room for everyone who wants to further such a strategy. No effort, as long as it represents fundamental moral constraints, is too limited or too personal to contribute in some way to a larger strategy. And she suggests we begin in a local way, as Gandhi also suggested, to carve out spaces or territories in personal relations where violence, say, or deceit will not be used. Now, this reminds me of when you say, violence, no problem for me. Deceit might get me, you know, where I'm not going to deceive anyone. Territories in relations in the family, in the community, with friends, even opponents, where we will have more control and also greater responsibility. Such an effort requires we consider the role of violence or deceit in our own work as news reporters or police officers, as public servants or industrial workers, as scientists or executives, and at home, with family and friends, in community service, recreation, and entertainment. Her point is, she spells out even more clearly how we can all find ourselves somewhere. There's a place for everybody, each of us in this. I see all who strive to reduce distrust as working for peace, even if they produce no immediate and direct effects on the nuclear balance of terror, whether in government offices, at the negotiating table, with children or with adults, in religious or in political groups, in private or public life, men and women who work to diminish the sway of violence or deception. And as I read these, think about all the ways that this impacts directly on you, not on what I saw over there with the neighbors. Men and women who work to diminish the sway of violence or deception or breaches of faith and of excessive secrecy are all doing the work of peace. They show that the opportunities for such work, should so one choose, are everywhere, and that change can begin, should so one choose, right away. And that's what I think is really important to feel. It can happen. We can work on it. Okay. Come around on a little bit on involvement. Want to say any more about partisanship or the passionate work in this?
No, I think it's good, the emphasis on faith. You know, faith that it can work out somehow, because so often it seems futile or useless. And why am I writing this letter to Congress?
Nothing is too small. In the same way, then, you can't really clean up on everything, but no act of violence is too insignificant either. And I guess in that sense, it's within ourselves that we can work. And I think that this can quickly get pretty heady and ethereal and all. And it's really hard sometimes, I think, to admit how violent I am inside, and what kinds of things are in there, and what anger is in there, and all. This is where I like very
What's
much.
What's wrong with anger?
Nothing.
I think that's okay.
Read what, and I'm just going to point out what Juni Nelson says. She did. You probably know her.
Yes,
from,
I do.
Yeah.
And you can't be she in works this part of the country that I'm John and Jenny.
Okay. Well, I don't have John up there yet, although
I
put Junie up.
Because, and his mother.
And her children, she's talking about two-year-olds, and they're angry. And and I was brought up that I shouldn't be angry. But she said, no, you can be angry. It's what you do with your anger that's important. And so that's... Yeah. What I think
no, I mean,
the important
I
thing
think
is.
When you were talking about the sense of dignity and worth and as the root of at the root, and I see that anger at injustice is seems to be
exactly.
I mean, and I think that is a very that is almost I'm not really with it's really instinctual, but it's very deeply inbred and often. We educate ourselves. I mean, it's miseducation to somehow put that aside. We don't allow our sometimes the anger to bear good fruit. I mean, anger also can obviously be harmful. But I think it's an energy that can go in the right direction.
That's what gets us moving. Sometimes, as long as we choose the proper direction.
Yeah.
Sometimes, if you're not angry, that's the problem.
Yes, right.
Right. There are things you need to be angry.
Lifton talks about the psychic numbing.
If you let it boil, and then you explode.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We address it the wrong way.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It
So there's nothing wrong with anger.
Yeah.
But there's, okay, we understand. Anyone else want to talk about anger a little bit?
just tell, let him do it with a bowling pin, you know. That's where you show your anger.
I was just going to say about anger. I mean, I had a friend once who says anger is okay, but violence isn't.
Where are these from?
But then they, at the same time, they get real angry and defensive and make accusations and stuff as well. I'm not hitting you, so this is just anger I'm expressing. It's like, you're accusing me of all kinds of things, you know. But, you know, obviously you're not hitting me, but that doesn't make, I just... For me, anger, yeah, how you use it, can include, I mean, you know, reading the Bible, just thinking it, you know,
right.
I mean, as soon as it hurts, words often hurt more than violence.
Oh, sure. These are some of the subtleties you alluded to earlier when you use language, the use of language.
Mm-hmm.
And it can really hurt, and language can be very violent. It is not a physical thing, it can be very violent.
At school, I teach the kids, sticks and stones may hurt your bones, but they will heal, and words will never heal.
Mm-hmm. You remember.
No, kids are horrible to each other.
They're horrible.
But, and this is a case where they said, look, if you're feeling angry, you say, I mean, this is ideal again with kids, you say, where is that coming from? Why are you feeling that way? And you say, I'm feeling that way because he took the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're angry about the ball being taken. But the more you can distance it from the person, the better. So you can direct it at the action.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're angry at an action. You're angry at that. And therefore, the person who says, in fact, I'm waiting to hear Chuck Huff tomorrow talk about how to blame others for your problems at 10:40. I don't know if you can come
back. Yeah, so,
but, you know, the thing is, that's blaming as much as anything else. And so it's inappropriate. And Junie talks about teaching children how to have appropriate outlets for their anger.
Yeah.
And that's a lot. That's peacemaking to me.
Mm-hmm. No, I think anger is a powerful feeling, but often, just as you said, often we feel angry because someone got in line ahead of me, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then at another level, you might feel anger because you see somebody the bully kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's bullying, and that's another level. But then so often, we learn all sorts of strategies for cooling, being cool and not. You have all this kind of spectatoritis.
Mm-hmm.
In a crowded subway in New York City, someone can be beaten up on somebody else, and somebody, you're reading the paper,
Mm-hmm.
So you may not be, if you're not angry then, that's would be, I would say, pathological in
mm-hmm.
a sense. I mean,
mm-hmm.
so, but I think we're often afraid of our anger because we don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it has very good uses, as you were saying, in terms of getting us out of our chairs when we do another, but it can also be very destructive.
Mm-hmm. Can I switch to, just for a second, with regard to peacemaking,
mm-hmm.
We haven't talked too much about scripture
mm-hmm.
and where that's at and so on. And over the last several years, I've been looking into it very, very deeply, mm-hmm. thinking about what we've been told about the just war tradition. And then doing a little bit of investigation in history, and I read very carefully Roland Bacon's book on the attitudes toward Christian attitudes toward war and peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew this, but I needed the information to prove it. Was for the first 3 centuries, Christians, those who were following Christ, those mm-hmm. who were following Christ's words in the gospel, were pacifists.
Or they weren't. Couldn't be a soldier in
Constantine and changed it, and that was not Christian.
Right.
It's
and even more than that, trusted. Christians yeah. weren't trusted.
Yeah.
It, I mean, if a Christian had wanted to join the army,
right.
it would have had to resign because they weren't trusted either.
Yes.
And
I think we Christians don't push that enough. We don't. We just go through, and I can remember 10 years ago here, we were going through the just war tradition and all
mm-hmm.
this kind of stuff. And I don't even remember a hint that this was a violation of scripture to justify violence. You can't. There's nothing in scripture that's going to justify violence.
Right.
No way. And I think we need to push that. I really need to advocate that.
The just war tradition includes a number of things. One of which is you know what your goals are. So you know what it is you're fighting for, and that's a valid thing to be fighting for, to free somebody from desperate things, let's say. And that the results of the war are going to be worth the cost, mm-hmm. that is to say that'll be balanced, mm-hmm. and that non-combatants will not be harmed. Mm-hmm. And it also has in it all other alternatives have been tried. And that's the one that everyone
and it's,
forgets.
And we've tried for long enough. See, a lot of times they say they're going to try them, but they don't try them for long enough.
But this was pushed at us at the beginning of the Persian Gulf War, and Billy Graham got up there and advocated it. He said, we fulfilled all of the requirements of the just war tradition.
Mm-hmm. Billy has his limits.
Billy has severe limits, but unfortunately,
yeah, but he also
he's got a lot of power.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'd like to suggest to you a study of St. Martin of Tours, mm-hmm. for whom Martin Luther was named, mm-hmm. and I think he gained a lot from that association with that name, but there's more there than, there's a lot more there than, do you know St. Martin? And do you want to say what you know about St. Martin?
I mean, the story that, I mean, I know he was a soldier in the Middle Ages, and I guess I'm not sure what year.
Very early on.
Early on, okay.
Yeah.
I've seen a painting of it, it's the only thing I've
seen. I think the story goes is that he saw a poor beggar and he gave him his cloak, or maybe cut his cloak in half,
right.
and gave him half of it. And after that time, mm-hmm. stopped being a soldier and started being a
There's a famous painting about that.
Yeah, El Greco, there are many paintings on it, I think El Greco has one. Yeah. He saw the soldier, he gave him half his cloak. That night, he dreamed he saw Christ coming towards him wearing the cloak.
Mm-hmm.
And from that dream, he became a Christian. And he resigned from the army.
Mm-hmm.
And he was accused of being, you know, a sissy and all. So he said he would stand in front of the battle without, but he had to lay down his arms because he saw Christ. Mm-hmm. And Christ, that meant that he could not bear arms because of the nonviolence of Christ. And so he offered to stand in front of the battle line unarmed. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that he feared the battle. But he refused to carry arms.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did leave the army. Mm-hmm. And he worked, they were fighting in Gaul and all over, mm-hmm. you know, what we now know as Germany, France, Italy, that area. Lots of fighting back and forth there. And the church also was beginning to become established there. So as a member of the church, he was there. And then the church itself was full of all sorts of doctrinal issues mm-hmm. and problems back and forth. And so further in his development, he was well loved. He never took any of the riches of the orders because Peter Brown says that the reason the Catholic orders began is that the church wanted to get control of the money. And the way they could do this was through these orders, which had enough of the really true, strong impulses of human nature that could be drawn on, and it was a way of then, you know, through fear and other maneuverings to develop that. That's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
But he refused to take part in any of those riches, and as bishop, lived a very simple life. But he also was a peacemaker in that he was very tolerant of other people's positions. And in fact, when there was a group in Spain that had some doctrinal difference about on one of these fine theological points, that caused the established church to want to kill them, basically, and at least cut them off, first cut them off so they'd be heathen again, and then kill them, he interjected and said, no, absolutely not. He would not, and he used his power to protect them and say, we need to respect the differences that we have here. And there were a number of things of this sort, and he was able to do this with basically moral force.
He was waiting for his time then, in a lot of ways.
Well, he was needed at that time, of course.
One person could do so much.
Those kind of people are always waiting for their time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's the one at St. Martin's Table in Minneapolis.
Not for Martin Luther.
Not for Martin Luther.
Sort of ironic, too. He was named after the god of war.
Yes, Mars. Yeah. And so there are a series of these things as well, stories about his ability to be, and it didn't mean that he gave up his own faith. And that was strong, but he was able to allow other people, to other groups, to have a difference of opinion, and to sort of say.
Did you get this from novels that you read or research that you did?
No, actually, you know, it's hard, and then you never know, in the lives of saints, what is truth, and when it's not. Through, you know, just through research and finding whatever I could about Martin Coors. And then I went to Assisi to follow the path of St. Francis. Says, and there is St. Martin everywhere.
Well, there's a lot of psychic energy that's always invested in those guys. I mean, the same is true about Jesus. You know, I'm going to have to preach Sunday from now where he walks on water.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you should see the movie.
Yeah, is that even, will he walk on water?
In Montreal, the movie our group has to see as a reading group.
Good.
Yeah, I agree. First, we have to get a hold of it.
But at any rate, so I invite you to take St. Martin on as a person you traced here and there. But his compassion and his strength and his commitment and his ability to tolerate other points of view. Now we get into these other issues of, okay, at what point then should moral anger come in? I think this was an issue of an interpretation of doctrine, of what God meant or what God would do, he probably was saying, well, let God decide that. It wasn't a matter of people hurting other people. It wasn't. This wasn't a matter of somebody taking away the rights of other people or destroying other people. So that's an important thing to remember.
Yeah.
But
as a matter of fact, I don't think I like moral anger because it tends to become moralistic. Mm-hmm. But I think as a matter of fact, I think.
Well, I mean, anger based on moral principle.
Right.
Well, Jesus and the money changers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
I would also think that his ability to affirm the faith of other people was an aspect of the strength of his own faith, and it's people whose own faith is someone on shaky ground who can't tolerate divergence.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess back to the thing I was talking before about the tricky part of choosing sides, because not all violence is a result of the class distinctions or the rich beating up on the poor. When you have most of them are like Northern Ireland or Palestine or Hindus and Muslims in India, it's just often just vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And then moral anger seems to me becomes a destructive thing.
Sure,
both sides are thoroughly convinced that they're right.
Sure,
and are rightly this mob just killed my son and. My whole family, therefore I have a right to be,
Sure.
It's just
all feuds in the Appalachians, too.
Yeah.
Well, the Native American tribes before we came, that was one of the...
Some were violent and some were peaceful.
Well, it was payback, too. It was mostly, payback's due to...
They had a sense of limit, so...
Well, I would say that is worldwide. All humans share a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of the opposite of peacemaking. It's war making. As I read articles about from people in Bosnia and Herzegovina, they say, what's frightening is people say, how could this have happened? And was this just because Tito held it all so much together that nobody could do anything? And that may have been part of it. But there have been people, leaders, who have been sort of sowing the seeds of hate in the last 5 years. That has fanned the flames so that there are people for whom doing these hateful things.
Well, that's one of the things you get a lot from NPR. What's this? Ernie Jelton's, Tom Jelton.
My pastor.
Yeah, Tom Jelton. That's, they've been wanting to say that this is just all old ethnic hatreds, but in fact they were all living together.
Mm-hmm.
Intermarried.
Well, a lot of them intermarried. Mm-hmm. They took husbands from wives and children from mothers, and they've done some horrible things.
I think demonstrates you talk about power, the power of corrupt leadership. Mm-hmm. You get corrupt people at the top, they can, as you were saying, with all of the power of the media to influence people, you corrupt people at the top and you have only one television station, their view of reality is...
Yeah, it really is like fascist overtones. I mean, anyone's calling it fascism, but that's what it is. I mean, when these leaders, flip up this frenzy.
We're
past 5:30.
I'm
just stupid question.
5:30.
Our hour is up, but we can continue to go as long as we'd like. But I certainly would like to hear more about how you feel about maintaining solidarity with all these marvelous, marvelous, with all these important experiences that you've had at very significant times.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the thing I'm not entirely sure about. Just because so often, you talk to both sides. Mm-hmm. When I visited Israel, it was like I stayed with a family who was thoroughly convinced, you know, I mean, they're Orthodox Jews and they're, they moved from the United States. The woman had, you know, grew up and survived Auschwitz, you know, the whole nine yards. And the son was a surgeon with the Israeli army in the Golan Heights and everything. So I just got, you know, and I stayed with them for 3 days. They were friends and friends I was traveling with. And then 3 days later, I traveled to the West Bank and go to Jordan and talk with the other. And it's like, and it's situations like that when I say, okay, making peace.